welcome to an evening of exploring the universe. I'm Rick Singeri. Tonight's special astronomy program is presented in collaboration with the Fairbanks Museum and Planetarium in St. Johnsbury. And our guest tonight is Mark Breen, who you know so well from our daily Eye on the Sky weather reports and from the Eye on the Night Sky program, which you hear at 4:30 in the afternoon on VPR. Mark is also the Planetarium Director at the Fairbanks Museum, and he has extensive knowledge of the night sky. Mark, thanks for joining us this evening.
It's a delight to be here.
All right. Before we get started, let's talk about the weather, one of your other expertises. What does it look like around the region tonight?
Yeah, well, we do have some breaks in the clouds. I guess that's about as much as we're going to hope for, at least in the next hour, although there may be a tendency for some clearing later on, and as we'll discuss through the show, later on might actually work out pretty well in terms of observing some meteors. There's also a cluster of showers I've been watching that they've been running across to, down near Springfield and just north of Brattleboro. They're working across the Connecticut River right now. There was some thunder with them earlier, but that seems to have dissipated, so that's the wettest location in our region right now.
All right, let's try to shush some of those away. And listeners, the weather may not be cooperating in your area, but even if you can't get outside and observe the night sky, we're going to be talking about the stars, taking you on a tour of the stars, the planets, the constellations, and we'll be answering your questions. You can join us with your questions or comments at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or if you'd like to email, you can email us at community@vpr.net. So, Mark, let's get oriented. Why don't you give us a quick tour of the night sky, a clear night sky?
Right. And almost always, and invariably, what I like to start with, and I think something that is familiar to a lot of folks, is to look for the Big Dipper. Now, this time of year, the Big Dipper tends to be in the northwest, relatively low, but not that low. Let's say about a quarter to a third of the way up from the horizon. And its familiar pattern consists of seven stars, three of which form a handle on the left-hand side, and then four makes a kind of a box or a dipper shape, so to say. And there we have the Big Dipper. Now, I find that it's kind of best in terms of getting yourself oriented to the sky to not try to look for too many things. So we're going to use that as one of our anchor points. And then I'm going to have you look now toward the south if you're kind of thinking about where that is from your location. You might not even have to get too fussy about it. As you scan the skies, there are two things that are going to show up pretty noticeably. There's a brilliant star in the west. Now, that's running closer to halfway up in the sky, a bright star known as Arcturus. And then we're going to work our way to the left of there, and significantly far to the left, lower in the sky, where you'll see two other bright objects. The two things we're looking at, and they're distinct in particular with color. On the right, slightly brighter, more of a pale yellow color, is the planet Saturn, and it's to its left, a little bit lower, we find a star named Antares. This star is the heart of the Scorpion in the sky. And as pictures go in the sky, as these constellations that we try to get people to imagine go, this one, I think, is a little easier than some. It has the shape of the letter S. So if you think of that red star as the middle of the S, slightly high up on that middle part, but it curves down and then curls just above the horizon. That's over toward the left. And then if you go to the right and then curve down from the red star, you can see the upper portion of that S. So there we have the basic outline of the Scorpion. The third place to go, and three is kind of a good number that way.
All right.
It's actually pretty high above you. You can look toward the east, but we're really directing your attention almost overhead. Brilliant star up there, and you might even see kind of a hint of blue to it. This is a star known as Vega. Dropping down from there, about halfway from there to the horizon, yet another bright star, Altair. And then to the left of both of these, not quite as bright, but it kind of noticeably fits in with these other two to form a fairly large triangle, very high up in the east. and that's known as the summer triangle. Mm. So if we take those three elements, we have the Big Dipper that we started with in the northwest, we've got the Scorpion in the south, and then this figure in the east, we've kind of looked at different sections of the sky and identified some places that I feel pretty confident that you can go outside for yourself, and you will find these particular three objects.
Well, Mark, one person who's already outside, and we want to make sure that she can continue to watch what you're talking about, is Kate from Nantucket. So let's see. Let's check in with Kate calling in from Nantucket. How you doing, Kate?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm actually from Heartland, Vermont, and I was sad that I was going to be on vacation and missing the stargazing party, but I'm listening to you on my iPod app, and I'm down on the beach, and it's crystal clear down here.
So I was just going to say, I can see it's clear down there.
So. Oh, how fantastic.
Yeah.
What are you seeing so far?
Well, I just saw a meteor, I believe.
Excellent.
All right, we are off to a great start.
Yeah.
Well, yep. Kate, thanks for checking in with us.
I'm glad you're doing it. I'm so excited to listen.
All right, keep watching. Super. Mark will take you through this evening. So Kate said she saw a meteor, and the reason we get together every August, Mark, is because of the Perseid meteor shower, which is in evidence at this time every year. Why don't we start with what a meteor is?
Sure. Meteors are probably, more commonly called shooting stars or falling stars. And I hope that most of you have certainly experienced that before. Sometimes you'll see a wonderfully bright one, but many times when we talk about these shooting stars or falling stars, they tend to be, tiny, quick little streaks of light up there. And what you're really seeing are these tiny little pebble-sized pieces of rock that are out in space. As they enter the Earth's atmosphere, they essentially burn up. And so you see this brief streak of light, and as we do so, we quickly notice it. It doesn't last very long, although a few of them may linger for 5-6 seconds. That would be quite a fantastic-looking one. Many of them just a second or so. And so these really, when we're talking about these objects, we're talking about something maybe the size of a garden pea, and it's probably some 60 to 80 miles above you, which actually begs the question, do you think you have that kind of eyesight that you can see a pea 80 miles away?
Right.
And so this has actually been fascinating for me as a sort of a process of discovery, educating myself about astronomy, is that we're not actually seeing the piece of rock. What's really going on is the rock is going somewhere between 40 and as much as 70,000 miles an hour. Mm. And as it does so, it actually compresses the air, and the air itself actually heats up and begins to glow. And it's the glowing atmosphere, not the rock, that you're seeing. And so that creates the glow and then the streak behind it. And so that's really what you're seeing when you see a meteor.
So that's a meteor. What is this Perseid meteor shower then?
Well, so you can go out on pretty much any night and see a few shooting stars or meteors. Now, what happens at certain times of the year, and of course this is one of the more prominent ones, certainly one of the best known ones, is that we run into a bunch of rocks, a bunch of these little pebbles, and they are the leftovers, the debris from a comet that has been orbiting the sun. And of course, as the comet, which is made of primarily ice, but it has embedded pieces of these little tiny rocks, as it gets close to the sun's energy vaporizes the ice. Well, sort of like a snowbank melting in the spring, what's left is the debris. And that debris, tiny pieces of rock, actually continue along the comet's orbit that goes around the sun. And if that orbit crosses close enough to the Earth's orbit, we run into the particles. Now, orbits, just like our own orbit, are very regular, very specific pattern. So in other words, if the comet keeps going around the sun in the same place over and over again, the Earth runs through those particles at the same time each year as we go through our orbit. Basically, the orbits kind of crisscross. And so we enter that little stream of debris every year between about August, around the 10th or so, and continuing out to about the 15th or 16th. But the real core of it, the middle of it, takes place on the 12th and 13th.
And does it make any difference, Mark, being in the northern or southern hemisphere of when you see the Perseid meteor shower?
Not date-wise, mm-hmm. but as it turns out, there are some meteor showers that are better seen from the northern hemisphere and others from the southern hemisphere, and that simply has to do with the fact that I think people sort of have this pretty good imagination and information that planets orbit the sun at pretty much the same level, sort of like on a desktop type of thing, you know. And so what happens with comets is they don't follow that pattern. They may drop down, say, below the orbits of the planets and then back up again. So they're on different angles, and depending on that angle, it may favor northern versus the southern hemisphere. These particular meteor showers are better seen from the northern hemisphere.
We are taking a tour of the cosmos tonight with Mark Breen. You can join us by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your questions or comments on the VPR Facebook page. So you've mentioned a few of the big players: Big Dipper, Scorpion, Summer Triangle. Any other major players we should be looking out for in this summer sky this evening, Mark?
Well, we happen to be, and this is kind of favoring both the meteors in terms of being able to see them, because we don't have the moon in the sky. Oh, and so I mention that because without the moon in the sky, we can see some other fainter things. And although it wouldn't seem like a faint object would be a major player, I think many of us are familiar with the Milky Way that arches across the sky. And so that's another key thing that, especially on a dark, moonless night, is a wonderful sight to see. And so stretching right from the south and very close to the red star that we described earlier with the Scorpion, we have that faint band of light that arches very high up into the north. And as it happens, it goes right through the Summer Triangle that we described. It then continues to curve back down toward the northern horizon. So that's definitely one of the things that if you head outside, you'll definitely want to enjoy some views of the Milky Way. Now, with that in mind, since we've mentioned the Scorpion and we've mentioned now the Milky Way, if you do look toward the south, where the Milky Way is relatively bright, there is another pattern of stars that actually shows up, I think, pretty nicely this time of year. I guess the best way to simply describe it is a teapot. Mm. And very often, it is known as such. It's obviously not an official constellation. it is part of a constellation known as Sagittarius. But the way to describe it is you've seen, hopefully, that S-shaped pattern of the Scorpion. So if we're looking just a little left of that, the teapot consists of a triangular top, and then the body of the teapot underneath that. It has a handle on the left-hand side, and a spout on the right, on the side where the Scorpion would be. And so it's a relatively simple picture, but the stars are moderately bright. So it's a pattern that does tend to stand out in our skies.
I want to run outside and see the teapot right now. So let's talk about the moon. You mentioned that. This is actually a good year because the moon is just a thin crescent right now. I think last year, didn't we have a supermoon during the Perseids?
It was getting brighter, yes, you're right. We had a lot of moonlight, actually, the past 2 years. As an approximate rule, about every 3 years, we get into a good spot in terms of the moon. All of that simply has to do with the fact the moon orbits the Earth once every approximately 30 days, but of course, the year doesn't quite work out that way. And we don't have 360 days in the year, but 365. And then there's some other fussy things that basically alter the moon's pattern by about 10 or 11 days every year. So, like I said, about every 3 years, we get a nice dark moonlit night.
So let's get those clouds away and have a perfect night for this. Now, let's get to the Big Dipper again. You mentioned
sure.
as one of the players out there tonight. It's one of my favorites, probably because it's an easy one to spot. Mm-hmm. But can we use the Big Dipper to find other stars?
Yes, in fact, that's one of the nice things that, about those three pieces that I mentioned. In fact, we kind of took advantage of that already. We were looking at the Scorpion location and then mentioned the teapot in Sagittarius. So let's do the same idea now with the Big Dipper. And so there are two key things, I think, that are pretty easy to spot. We'll start with the brighter one first. If we use the handle part of the Dipper, it has a bit of a curve to it, and another word for curve is arc, A-R-C. And I mention that specifically because if you follow that arc, and with the Big Dipper kind of sitting about a third of the way up above the horizon, if you follow this arc, it'll come due west to a brilliant star. And there are two things about this star. One, it is brilliant in and of itself. It is the brightest star that we can see in the summer skies. So that certainly helps it to stand out. But it also happens to be in a region of the sky that's fairly lacking in bright stars. So we are looking at Arcturus. And the way to remember its name, because it's obviously not perhaps a household name, but you literally arc to Arcturus by following that curve or arc on the handle of the Dipper. In fact, there's an interesting little side note about Arcturus. Arcturus, its distance from the Earth is about 36 light years away. In other words, it takes light 36 years for the light from that star to reach us here. Back in, I think it was the Chicago World's Fair of 1933, the previous World's Fair in Chicago was 36 years previous.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually used the light from that star. They kind of refocused it through a telescope, had it hit a photocell that triggered the lights to turn on the lights at the World's Fair in Chicago in 1933.
Wow. That is crazy.
Interesting story. Okay, now I don't want to lose track. So, yes, you can use the Big Dipper to find Arcturus. But the other key thing, and I think this is something that folks have at least somewhat familiar with, but let's make sure that we're all kind of on the same page with that. On the other end of the Dipper portion, the two stars on the outer edge of the Dipper, they're relatively close together. They're also fairly bright. And so if we connect the dots, making a line, and then extend that line, we're going to go a bit upwards on an angle, and we're going to look due north halfway up in the sky. And so that line is going to guide you to a medium bright star. Not really bright, certainly noticeable, though. That is the North Star, or sometimes called Polaris as well. And Polaris, very famous. It's the guide star. There's lots of legend lore about it. But as you can see, it's not the brightest star in the sky. It ranks about the 25th brightest star that we can see from our vantage point in the northern hemisphere. So there you have, certainly a bright enough star that you can locate it. It's exactly above north, and it stays in that spot the entire time.
Wow.
The North Star is the end star of the Little Dipper. So the Little Dipper is noteworthy in terms of its comparison with the Big Dipper, but in terms of the stars that we've looked at so far tonight, it's certainly among the dimmer ones. The handle of the Dipper, the Little Dipper, goes from the North Star. It curves up and a bit left, so it kind of bends a little bit back toward the Big Dipper, and then on top of it, you'll see a little tiny rectangle of stars, and that's the Dipper portion of the Little Dipper.
Does the Big Dipper make fun of the Little Dipper?
I haven't heard that, but that sounds like the makings of a great story.
I don't know what's going on up in that sky. So we see these constellations from here on Earth in two dimensions. If we were seeing the Big Dipper in three dimensions, how would it differ from what we see? I mean, are those stars really far apart?
Well, it's kind of curious, and again, these are some things that have kind of come to light in the past few decades. The Big Dipper consists of seven stars.
Mm-hmm.
Five of them are actually sort of part of a grouping of stars that would have, millions of years ago, been much closer together. So they're actually gravitationally bound. There's a bit of gravity in between each of them. They're all about the same distance from the Earth, which in terms of, again, when we talk about the distance of stars, we usually talk about light years. And so they're the average about 85 light years from the Earth. They are the middle five stars. If you look to the extremes, either the far left, upper left, or to the lower right, those two stars are not at all connected with those two. So, like you said, it is kind of a, we don't have that sense of it in three dimensions, but those two stars are in the order of 160 to 180 light years away. So they are nowhere in the same region in space. They're moving actually in slightly different directions as well. Stars, although we don't think about them moving in the greater sense, because truly your grandchildren and their grandchildren will still see this pattern that we know as the Big Dipper. But over time, over many years, the end star on the Dipper is actually going to move down, so to say, toward the horizon as you're looking at it tonight. Meanwhile, the star that forms the outer corner of the Dipper portion on the far right, that star is actually heading more to the right. And so in about 50 or 60,000 years from now, you won't recognize the Big Dipper.
We're going to be spilling some stuff out of that Dipper.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. All right. So we are having a wonderful night of astronomy. Got Mark Breen here. Great time to pick his brain about anything you've ever wondered about in the night sky. You can give us a call, 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. If you have a question or comment you want to email, you can send that to community@vpr.net. And, Mark, a couple that I want to just throw in here. First of all, Pat asks, is there any way to predict when the Northern Lights will be on display? Could their presence or likelihood be posted somewhere?
Yes. In fact, I will guide you to a great website that, one, you can go to the website and they will talk about the possibility of Northern Lights. But, two, they actually have an email alert system that you can subscribe to. Wow. For free. So you get an email blast anytime there might be the potential for some Northern Lights. So the website that I'm talking about, it's a fairly easy one. It's all one word. It's called spaceweather.com. And that is it's a fascinating site because it talks about a lot of these different things, including the Perseid meteor shower, a lot of things that have to do with astronomy. But it does give us a kind of a little heads up in terms of nights that are more favorable to that. The thing that's been going on in particular, and it has to do with Northern Lights and the sun, is that the sun has been less active than normal. And because of that, less activity means fewer displays of Northern Lights. It doesn't mean zero, but it certainly reduces the number that we sometimes see. So that's just another factor in being able to view them.
All right. I hate to admit this, but I've never seen the Northern Lights yet. So I've still got something to live for and look forward to.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay, we also heard from Nichol in Guildford, who I know is a big fan of the International Space Station. So he sent along this note. According to the Heavens Above website, there won't be an International Space Station flyover during our show tonight.
That's right.
But there will be, he says, after the show. It will rise in the northwest at 10:06, will disappear by passing into the Earth's shadow near the Little Dipper at about 10:10 p.m. after reaching a maximum brightness of -2.9 magnitude. Is that very bright? Would we see something, a flash or something at that point?
Well, it wouldn't be so much a flash. What you will see is a very brilliant object moving relatively quickly across the sky. As Nichol mentions, I've actually got a slightly different timing noted that it would appear at 10:08, okay. But I'm looking specifically at a Montpelier. I kind of picked the middle part of our listening area, so that often does vary by a minute or two. So I would certainly suggest folks that want to go outside and find it, start just shortly after 10.
As soon as we wrap up the show, get outside.
Absolutely. But, yeah, it should be a fine sight, and it'll be more than halfway up in the sky, so it'll be pretty easy to spot that way.
That's exciting. All right, so Eric from Glover is calling, and Eric has a favorite star that he wants to know about. Eric, thanks for calling our astronomy show tonight. What's your question for Mark Breen?
Well, just just want to tell you, Mark, we love your show. We listen every year.
Great.
We're up on the Sheffield Square.
Yeah.
And we were just wondering if we could see Cassiopeia tonight. It's kind of in and out of the clouds, but we're hopefully we're going to see something.
Oh, yes. And so you're going to want to look to the north. In fact, maybe we can use a few things that we've already mentioned. This will help, I think, all of our listeners. So we've mentioned the Big Dipper, and we've mentioned the North Star. And so I often think, when I look myself for Cassiopeia, I use the North Star as kind of a middle point. So in other words, if I see the Big Dipper on one side of it, I look exactly opposite, and that's where you're going to find Cassiopeia. Now, the basic pattern to look for is kind of a W or zigzag shape. Obviously, it'll depend on how you're viewing it, and it also depends on what time of year. But the pattern this, you know, tonight is going to be a W that is tilted a little bit down and to the left. Five fairly prominent stars, about the same brightness as the stars of the Big Dipper, and about the same height above the horizon. So we're talking, maybe about a third to almost halfway up above the horizon in the north-northeast. So it's, again, kind of a mirror of the Big Dipper being in the northwest. You would see it in the northeast.
Wow, that's great. Now, another one that I always love that you talk about, you spoke about earlier, I think it's in Scorpion, is the Red Star Antares. So is it really red?
Yes, it really is. It is definitely one of the more fascinating stars as far as that goes. Antares, well, actually, let's just talk briefly about star color since you mentioned that. So Antares is a reddish-colored star, and the color of stars basically indicates their outer temperature. So out near the surface, so to say, some stars really don't have a surface the way a planet has a surface, but that's the part that we see, and so it gives us an indication of temperature. Now, it kind of is a bit counterintuitive. Usually we think blue as cold and red as hot, but as stars go, exactly the opposite. So orangish red colored stars are actually relatively cool, and the bluish colored stars are some of the hottest stars that we can see. Our sun, just for comparison, I mean, all you have to do is ask a kid to draw the picture of the sun, they draw it yellow. And our sun is indeed considered a yellow star, although it's certainly a whitish yellow as far as that goes. Now, star color in terms of seeing it in the sky is sometimes a bit of a challenge. Two things affect that. One, sometimes it's your own eyes. Some people's eyes are a bit more sensitive to color than others. But the other consideration is that sometimes if you look directly at a star, you may not get as good a perception of its color. So I would suggest that if you're looking perhaps right now over toward the south and southwest, and that's where Antares is found, look just a little bit off to either side of it, right or left, doesn't matter. And you may get just a little better hint of its reddish color.
And you said because it's red, it's a cooler star. So can I actually touch it? How hot would that star be?
Yes, that might not be advised. So the surface temperature is between about 3,500 and 4,000 degrees Celsius. So it's not as hot as our sun, which has a surface temperature closer to 5,800 degrees Celsius. But it's obviously, you know, all stars are blazingly hot. And just for comparison, on the other end of the scale, some of the bluish white stars have temperatures running anywhere from 10 to as much as 40,000 degrees Celsius. They're just incredibly hot.
That is a wide range of temperatures. Let's take another call, Mark, before we go to a break.
Sure.
Don is calling from Waterbury Center. Don, thanks for calling us this evening. What's your question or comment for Mark?
Hi, Mark. I was wondering, do you know how the six sisters got their name?
Ah, yes. So we have the sisters, sometimes known as the Pleiades, and I think I'm not sure if you're wondering about the sister idea or the Pleiades, but it actually kind of ties in. This goes back to the Greeks, as do many of our star names and so forth. The Pleiades are a group of sisters. They are daughters, and this kind of varies depending on the Greek author that penned various stories about them, but the one that I'm most familiar with is that they are daughters of Neptune. Neptune, of course, the god of the sea, I guess that's the Roman name. I tend to interchange them. Poseidon, of course, would be the Greek god of the sea. They are also, in other stories, the daughters of Atlas. And so they were known as sisters in Greek times, but as it turns out, they were also known as sisters in a few other cultures, including some Native American, I believe the Pawnee tribe from the Great Plains, also referred to them as the sisters. And I think in western New York State, the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee, they also have a story about them, although they're not sisters. It turns out they're called the Seven Starry Dancers, and they're young boys who went off and started drumming and dancing and so forth, not realizing that that's a very powerful ceremony that they do. And the ceremony was so powerful that as they drummed and sang and danced, they danced their way all the way up into the heavens, and that's how the Seven Starry Dancers got up there.
Wow, a great story, Mark. You're listening to a special Eye in the Sky astronomy show on VPR. You can join our conversation about what we see when we look up in this August sky on a clearer night. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or send an email to community@vpr.net. Welcome back to this special Eye on the Sky astronomy show on VPR. I'm Rick Sengary with Mark Breen of the Eye on the Sky fame and the Planetarium Director at the Fairbanks Museum. Tonight's program is presented in collaboration with the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury. And despite the overcast skies throughout much of our region tonight, we're here live to give you a tour of the cosmos, taking your questions or comments. You can also give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also send your questions or comments to community@vpr.net. Or you can post them on the VPR Facebook page. Now, Mark, we're getting some questions about the Perseid, so let's go back to that. First of all, why is it called the Perseid meteor shower?
A great question, and obviously very appropriate. The Perseid shower, Perseid meteor shower, gets its name from the constellation Perseus. As constellations go, not necessarily the most prominent or brightest grouping in the sky, and this time of night, it's just beginning to rise above the horizon, so it's not even fully visible right now. But the way that most meteors are meteor showers are named has to do with their origin point in the sky. Now, that takes a little bit of explaining, and it's kind of a fascinating way to try to imagine this. I did mention earlier that the Earth tends to pass through this debris, these tiny pebbles or rocks that burn up in our atmosphere, and then we see the shooting stars or meteors. Now, in this particular case, as the Earth is traveling through this part of our orbit, it happens to be that where this constellation is located, that's approximately the direction that they enter our atmosphere from. Now, the confusing part is you don't necessarily want to be looking toward Perseus to see this meteor shower. Perseus, who's rising just now into the north and northeast, that is obviously, you know, you would tend to think, I should be looking to the northeast. My advice instead is to actually lay down and look straight up. It will give you your best opportunity to see any meteor that goes on by. So if you think about that as an origin point, the northeast, then the streak of light may not actually start in the northeast. It might start above your head. And so if that's the case, you might see meteors kind of radiating either toward the northwest from where you're laying down, which if you put your head to the north, that's going to be kind of to your upper right, or they may streak by directly over you and head toward your right, or maybe they scoot along the southern horizon, they kind of head to your lower right. So those are kind of ways to imagine it. Now, it would seem as a result, what I just described is that they're going in different directions. Oddly, That's not the case. Think of it instead as looking down a set of railroad tracks. You know that the tracks are, of course, the same distance apart, but as you look farther and farther into the distance, they appear to come together. So what we're really seeing are meteors that are so far away that they appear to come from a small location and then spread out, when in fact, it's simply a matter of distance, and they're not really spreading apart. It's just that they're getting closer to you, so you have that perspective of them spreading apart.
Excellent. Now, Alice is calling from Colchester. She has another question about Perseus. So, mm-hmm. Alice, thanks for calling. What's your question for Mark?
Well, hi, Rick. Hi, Mark. Hey. Actually, I was interested in hearing about Perseus, and I just have been disabused of my perception that that's where they came from, was that I should be looking at Perseus to see the meteors. But I just want to let you know, I have seen a couple of meteors go by.
Great.
And it's really cleared out. It's clear. I'm in Colchester, and it's really cleared out, so I'm seeing a lot of stars.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And, I can see the summer, the triangle. So it's actually pretty not too bad night for viewing.
Excellent. Oh, fantastic. That's great to hear. Hey, so we have another call from Bob in Bridport. He wants to give us a little bit of Six Sisters information. Bob, thanks for calling. What do you got for Mark?
Oh, well, I lost the name in Greek for the Seven Sisters. But if you want to see the layout, look at any Subaru.
Oh, yeah.
The logo in the oval there is the Pleiades. Ah, I came back. And that's the word for Pleiades in Japanese. Now, what their legend is, I have no idea.
Oh, so Subaru is the Pleiades in Japanese. That's what Bob's saying.
Correct. That's right. And I have heard them described as the broom stars. So in terms of what, you know, how they sort of view them, I think they're sort of imagining them as a sprinkling of stars up there. And again, I'm not completely familiar with that particular viewpoint, other than the fact that, yes, I notice it on Subaru cars.
All right. And, the Pleiades are red hot tonight. Christine is calling from St. Johnsbury. She wants to talk about them, too. Christine,
okay.
Thanks for calling. What do you want to tell us about the Six Sisters?
My question is, how do I locate them in the sky?
Okay. Well, if you're going to look for the sisters, you're going to have to be a little patient. They're not up in the sky just yet. I know they're a wonderful and kind of favorite constellation for folks to look for, but they take a little bit of time to come up into our sky. So a couple of things about meteors, and certainly worth noting, and the Pleiades are kind of a nice way to talk about that. The viewing of meteors, although it's great that we can talk about it right now, but, you know, between 9 and 10 o'clock is a comfortable time for many folks to be listening. But the best viewing is actually after midnight. And so, at that point, as the Earth is spinning, it's also turning into the direction we're orbiting the sun. And that pushes more material into our atmosphere. We see a greater number of shooting stars. Now, I want to get to your question about seeing the Seven Sisters. So they're going to be coming up just after midnight in the east northeast, and I think one good way to sort of find them, and they're not the easiest thing to find, but if you wait, here you go. This is one of the things about astronomy. It's great if you can wait till 2 o'clock tomorrow morning. At 2 o'clock tomorrow morning, they will be almost due east and about one-third of the way up from the horizon. The two things that will help kind of center them, there'll be a bright star below them. That's the eye of Taurus, the bull. There'll be a bright star well to their left, a star named Capella. And you'll want to look not exactly at them, but again, I mentioned this earlier about seeing star color. Don't look straight at them, but just a little off to the side, and they will appear as a smudge of stars. And that's that little concentration. Your eyes can easily see six. They're often described as the Seven Sisters. People with really good eyesight have reported to see as many as 10 or 12 stars there.
Wow. So have another cup of coffee, Christine, and that way you'll see your constellation and some more of the meteors. We've been talking about the Perseids, mm-hmm. but are there other meteor showers throughout the year that are easy to see from where we are here in Vermont?
But that's kind of a yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of meteor showers that are scattered throughout the year for reasons that are really just random. There are very few meteor showers from about the middle of January to the middle of April. So that's kind of a blank spot in terms of seeing any meteor shower activity. But we get into late April, we get a meteor shower known as the Lyrid meteor shower, and it kind of kicks off a season. And so there are a couple more during the month of May. July and August, not only do we have the Perseids this time of year, but prior to this, so like the very last few days of July, all the way through most of August, we see another grouping. They're known as the Delta Aquarid meteors. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have nearly as fancy a name, but the Delta Aquarid actually refers to a star, Delta Aquarius, and that star is the center point, or that radiant point that we discussed earlier. And in general, they are fewer, but they tend to be slightly larger pieces, so you get these nice big streaks out of them. So those tend to be kind of fun to watch. Some of the best meteor showers in terms of numbers are in December and January, and that's a good thing. The skies are dark for a long, long period of time, so we have the Geminid meteor shower in December, close to the 11th and 12th, and then we have the Quadranted meteor shower, and that's in early January, right around the 4th and 5th. The difficulty with those two, even though they're very prominent in terms of numbers, that's our cloudiest time of the year.
Ah, damn. Well, I love the name the Delta Aquarid, a great band name in case we ever start jamming. Mark, we're getting a lot of calls. If you want to join the conversation this evening, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to David in Waterbury. David, thanks for calling this evening.
Hi. Thank you. Mark, I appreciate your show. You mentioned a few moments ago about discerning the heat of stars by blue or red. They're counterintuitive in color. But does that explain, is that when I hear the terms redshift or blue shift, is that what that means?
No, that's actually not related to that. But it's certainly terminology that you hear a lot about. And so what that's referring to, something a bit more familiar to all of us, is the spectrum or the rainbow. And so what they're talking about in terms of a redshift or a blue shift has to do with something we know as the Doppler effect, which I think we know sound-wise. You know, as a car, especially maybe a car with a siren, speeds up and is coming toward you, the pitch is very high. And then as it goes past you, the pitch then drops down and is lower. And it all has to do with sound waves. Well, light waves actually do the same sort of thing. And so if light is progressing toward you, and let's just use a star as an example, if a star is actually moving toward us, it'll actually kind of pack the light waves a little tighter together, and as a result, it shifts the light toward blue, a higher frequency. If the star or object is moving away from us, then it tends to stretch those light waves out a little bit, and it heads toward the red end of the spectrum, a little bit lower energy.
Good thing I didn't take that, because I would have said redshift, blue shift is a political phenomenon. So, all right, Ken has a rather metaphysical question. He's calling from Shelburne. Ken, thanks for calling. What do you got for us?
Hi, Ken. I am just wondering what are more, stars in the sky or grains of sand on the earth?
I haven't counted either. And I've actually heard this before. It's not coming to mind. I would say one of the things that's kind of impressed me, this year, we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope. One of my most fascinating moments with the Hubble had to do with them pointing it in a direction that from the Earth we had seen nothing. It was a blank space. And when they pointed the Hubble at it, they saw hundreds and hundreds of galaxies. And each of those galaxies contains millions and millions of stars. So I guess if, just based on that, I think I'd kind of lean toward there may be more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand on the Earth.
Wow, that is phenomenal. Well, we're in the Milky Way galaxy. Our nearest neighbor is the Andromeda galaxy. What do we know about that galaxy?
Well, it's really kind of the first galaxy that we identified, so to say. For a long time, you know, we knew that there were these other fuzzy patches out there, but we really didn't have the telescopes to be able to truly identify what those fuzzy patches were. Because even in a very powerful telescope, the Andromeda galaxy does look like a smear or smudge of light. It wasn't until just this past kind of generation of telescopes, and so we're talking about things like the Hubble Space Telescope, now we can actually see individual stars. But if we go back about a century, that's when this great debate was being sort of formulated. What are we looking at? And so we basically started seeing an exploding star or a supernova in another galaxy. And suddenly it was like, ah, we actually now know, we can confirm. You know, there was an idea that they might have been made out of stars, but then we were able to confirm it. And so the Andromeda galaxy is the nearest galaxy to our own, and it's very similar. Both of them are what we know as spiral galaxies. So there is a core, and out from that core, there are these spiral arms that kind of pinwheel out from the center. And so that describes both our Milky Way galaxy, but also the Andromeda galaxy. Mm.
I read where, Mark, where these two galaxies are set to collide in 3.75 billion years, so should we be worried?
Well, I wasn't planning on being around that long, but there are some amazing images now where they can actually see what happens when galaxies collide.
Wow.
And apparently that's not an uncommon thing, but obviously, as you mentioned, we're talking about these enormous spans of time. And in spite of the fact that we have these two galaxies, both containing hundreds of billions of stars, as they interact with one another, most of the stars will simply pass between each other.
I'll get out of here.
I know. It's kind of hard to imagine. I guess maybe one way to think about it, you know, as we look out into the sky, you know, the nearest stars are in the order of 20 trillion miles away. I mean, it's a number with a lot of zeros. The distances are so phenomenal in between stars that there's actually a lot more room than you might think.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right, let's get back to the calls. We got Matt calling in from Waterbury. Matt, thanks for calling this evening. What do you got for us?
Hi, well, I'm actually in Ferrisburg, but my 3.5-year-old daughter Eliana's favorite star is Vega, and she loves the summer triangle. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little about Vega and Deneb and Altair.
Oh, sure. So a couple of things about that. One of the things that I like about the whole idea of the summer triangle is that it's not an old constellation. In fact, it's not really a constellation at all. It is what we know as an asterism, which is just a fancy word that means a pattern of stars. And it dates back into the 1950s, and there are two probably separate sources essentially coining the phrase at the same time but not really realizing it. One of them might be familiar to folks. There's a author and illustrator, H.A. Rey, who did the Curious George books. But he also wrote a book called The Constellations, which was then retitled eventually The Stars. It is still in print. It's one of my favorite recommendations in terms of understanding the sky and stars. And in his book, he talked about the summer triangle with Vega, Deneb, and Altair, the three stars. But at the same time, a very famous astronomer in England, Sir Patrick Moore, also talked about that on his very famous BBC broadcast, a broadcast that lasted for over 50 years. It was the longest-running program on BBC. So that's, you know, a little background in terms of the Summer Triangle. Vega itself, I find fascinating because the name Vega actually has, I think, it's kind of an interesting little history. Its name originally in Arabic was El-Wika, and it eventually got kind of translated and transmuted and so forth through the Germanic language as Wiga, or pronounced Vega, and hence we have it today. But El-Wika, its origin, means the falling or swooping eagle. And in Arabic countries, instead of imagining it as part of the Summer Triangle, they actually imagine it as the head of an eagle in the sky.
Well, that's fantastic. And you also got to love that Matt's three-year-old daughter has a favorite star.
That's fabulous.
I love that. All right, let's talk to Lon calling from Rochester. Lon, what do you got?
Yes, I'm calling you from Rochester, New York.
Oh,
and
okay.
I lived in Vermont for 25 years in Fairhaven before I moved back here, and we are listening to you out in the backyard.
Excellent.
Clear sky, and we're listening to you on a smartphone.
Oh, how exciting. Great. What are you seeing, Lon?
Huh?
What are you seeing out there?
It is clear so far, and we're seeing a meteor here and there, but it's still pretty early.
All right.
Right.
Great. Thanks for checking in.
We're going to try and get up about 2 o'clock in the morning and go back out.
That's the spirit.
That sounds wonderful.
That's what Mark's recommending. And now let's talk to Bob in Waterbury. Bob, thanks for calling. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, more a question. So my son and I are enjoying a crystal clear night here in Waterbury at some brilliant meteors. But what are the very slow moving faint lights that are just going in straight lines? Are they satellites? Are they very, very high flying planes?
Yeah, you're seeing satellites. There are literally thousands and thousands of them up there. This time of night, just after it's gotten, you know, basically completely dark, you're still looking at objects that are so far above the Earth's surface that they're actually still catching sunlight up there. So that's what you're seeing in terms of the actual source of light. They're reflecting sunlight, but they move on a steady pace, and it's very typical that you go outside and you'll see satellites just kind of gradually working their way across the heavens.
Boy, that's exciting. We have another call from Maya. Let's hear from Maya. Do you have a question for Mark? Hi, do we have Maya? No? All right. So, Mark, this has been a really exciting year for astronomy when you think about Pluto and the New Horizons space probe heading out there, getting us those great photos. Should we still care about Pluto now that it's a dwarf planet?
Of course we should. I think, you know, anybody with an interest in astronomy had to be absolutely blown away. I'm still a bit speechless in terms of how much activity was going on Pluto. It's certainly, you know, a lot of us kind of visualized maybe it was just kind of this inert, you know, icy object sitting out there, but that's not at all what we found. We found mountains and what appears to be some sort of active geological sort of stuff going on. And you know, so it's fascinating because it changes what we thought. And that, of course, is, you know, just a springboard to working that much more on the science of why it is the way it is. We don't know that answer. Curiosity obviously drives a lot of that. And a lot of times, you know, we'll go about answering a question. You know, for example, we saw a little bit about the atmosphere of Pluto. But we don't understand that completely. In the process of understanding that, not only do we hopefully answer that question, but we might either raise several more questions, or we might find answers to other questions that we didn't expect to, you know, be able to answer because we were looking at Pluto, and suddenly there's the answer.
Pluto will always be a planet to me. Maya's calling from Randolph. I think we've got Maya now. All right. What do we got, Maya? Hi there. Do you have a question for us?
Hi,
Maya.
What's your question?
I was wondering why shooting stars in the sky. They're going in different directions, but why aren't they going in the same direction in the sky?
Great question.
Ah, okay. Well, I guess you can think of it in terms of just how far away they are, because you know, when we see them go across the sky, we don't really have a good idea, I think, with our eyes, how far up they are. And so they are, most of them, about 60 or 80 miles away. So if you think, if you're looking, maybe you're on like a big road or something like that, and you think about both sides of the road, but if you look way off in the distance, the road gets very narrow. So it almost looks like the road spreads apart, but you know, the road doesn't spread apart. And that's really what happens with those shooting stars. There is one other thing, though, that's helpful to know, is that not all the shooting stars we're seeing, not all the meteors, are Perseid meteors. They may indeed be coming from a different direction. So that's another reason to see them moving in a different direction, is that they might not be a Perseid meteor. They may be coming from some other place.
Oh, sure. Throw that little twist in at the very end. Hey, Mark, you know, it's really exciting. Every year we do this, we always hear from young people are interested. How young were you when you start to really be fascinated by the night sky?
Well, curiously, it wasn't until I came here at the museum. Now, I had seen the Big Dipper. You know, I had watched the moon up in the sky, but I really didn't know much more than that when I started doing planetarium shows here at the museum. And so I think for me, kind of as an adult learner of astronomy, I've been able to, I hope, to share that because I've gone through that same process of discovery and excitement, and I love sharing that idea with everybody else.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being part of this every year. It really is enlightening. I want to thank everyone also for joining us for tonight's Eye in the Sky Astronomy Show. Thank you, Mark.
Oh, I've had a great time tonight.
Tonight's broadcast was presented with the Fairbanks Museum and Planetarium in St. Johnsbury. And this program was produced by Liam Connors with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the program. I'm Rick Zingari. I want to thank you for listening. Have a great night. And remember, tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll be talking about cellophane. So we'll continue more talk about astronomy. Take care.